Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greenhorns, this is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. Today, coming to you from the freshly rained upon hills of Southern California, joined by Effie and Todd, who are, I think, in Oakland. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello there.
Hey, Severin.
Are you guys in the same room sharing one phone?
No, we're not.
No, we are not.
Oh, wow, we're getting sophisticated.
Yeah.
So Effie and Todd are both part of the Occupy the Farm project and the Occupy the Farm film, and super exciting to have them on the show and to learn more and spread the news to all of you about the budding land occupation movement in the United States. I wonder if we could start with Effie. Just give us a brief summary of what's going on and what has been going on, and then maybe contextualize it in the kind of international way.
Sure. Thanks, Severin, for having us on and for asking those questions. So the struggle for the Gill Tract is a story that has a lot of different applications, like you alluded to, and it definitely invites the food justice movement of the United States to think about that larger global context of really how do we talk about food justice without talking about land? And this is something that the folks in the Global South have been looking at for a long time. And the Gill Tract is a 20-acre historic farm that's just north of Berkeley that has belonged to the University of California since the early 1920s, and started out as 100-acre prime piece of farmland, and was bought by the university in order to do agricultural research. And as research agendas shifted over the next 100 years, more and more of that land was used for things other than agricultural research. It was developed into housing, it was developed into shopping, and much of the research that did remain there was for research that was for a patent-producing agenda, so genetic research and things of that nature. So the struggle for the Gill Tract is a story of land. It's a story of our public institutions, and it's a story of what a community can do to kind of push back in an atmosphere where those resources, those public resources, are increasingly not being used for a public agenda, public serving agenda. Is that kind of the general broad background you were looking for?
So we got a little history about the Gill track and the changing research agendas. And bring us up to date with your actions so far. And maybe, Todd, do you want to introduce your documentary process? When did you get involved with the Gill track, and what were you filming?
Sure. I had done some research about urban farmers in Oakland, and had been trying to propose it as a something to do on television, and that got nowhere. And during the Occupy movement of 2011, I was out in front of Oakland City Hall and recognized some of the urban farmers I had met doing research from Oakland, and put one and one together and realized that at some point the Occupy movement would join the urban farming movement and there would be an occupation, and that would make a great story. So I just bided my time, and 6 months later, Effie and her organization and friends occupied the Gill track. I got news of it and sent some friends over right away, and then came up there with a camera and joined the occupation with a camera and followed the story for the next 2.5 years. And the result was a hour and a half feature documentary that played in theaters all across the United States.
So, I've seen the film. It's super awesome, and it's also really cool, like little interludes. Can you just give a little bit of a sense of what's on the screen? Like, what do people see? I mean, it's pretty unique. There's a lot of farm films, but there's not a lot of films about land occupation. You want to talk about the vibe?
What sets this film apart is that it's a story about real people fighting for one piece of land and what the fate of this land is going to be. Is this public land going to remain in the public sphere for public research, or is it going to get privatized for real estate development purposes? That was the essential question on day one of the occupation. Other cameras, not mine, some activist, a guy named Peter from San Francisco, was there with the occupiers, and he recorded 200 people breaking through the padlock, walking out of this land with wheelbarrows, tools, 15,000 seedlings, and they planted 2 acres. They cleared a couple of acres and planted a full acre of crops on their very first day before the authorities even walked onto the place. So it was a very unique action, and it had a lot of hope, and it had a lot of people involved in it. And so it was a very lively story to follow, and the people on all sides of this story that are in the film were really passionate about the issue. And while it is both an important issue in the real world, and because we were there just at the right time to capture it, it makes a really great story on screen as well.
So, Effie, do you want to give us an update? The land was occupied and farmed. There's a series of sagas with police, occupation, negotiation with researchers, people being arrested, just like everything that goes down went down. Do you want to give us a little bit of an update as to what's going on right now with the Gill track? And
thanks, definitely. So spoiler alert for the documentary. The struggle for the land actually created a chain of events that meant that a good portion, about half of those 20 acres, were transferred back into the hands of the College of Natural Resources that was taken off of the block for development. And that meant that we had an opportunity, the college had an opportunity, and the community had an opportunity to work together to create a collaborative project, which we have been doing now for over 2 years, creating 20,000 pounds of organic produce in the first year without a crop plan or a lot of four organizations, just kind of communities coming together and figuring it out, along with some really awesome resources.
Well, didn't you even not have water when you were growing those vegetables? Like, you had to carry all the water over the fence, right?
Yeah, well, that was those initial weeks when we had an actual occupation happening there. And then what happened since then was that, we kept on accessing the land. You know, eventually it meant it wasn't about the occupation, it was about the access. It was about continued stewardship of that land, which we kept on persisting in even after those initial weeks of occupation. And so eventually the College of Natural Resources said, well, hey, let's work together on this. Let's create a project. And so now we're stewarding a project, and will be for at least another 6 years. I hope to see it go on forever, where we've got educational programming and some research and some production that benefits the community directly. We also have an ongoing campaign for the land that for the 10 more southern acres of the total 20 acres of the Gill Tract, which is in danger of development still, for a shopping and housing complex. And so we're encouraging a boycott of one of the anchor tenants of that development, which is Sprouts Farmers Market. For those who've been there, it's not a farmers market. It's actually a completely greenwashed version. It's a big box store, so I encourage anyone, even if you don't care about the Gill Tract, struggle to boycott that store because they are undercutting real farmers and real farmers markets. So, our struggle continues through that campaign and also through direct action on the land. It's also been really beautiful to see the involvement of the Ohlone community, which is the indigenous community in the Bay Area. There's a group called the Indigenous Land Access Committee that has become involved with bringing the Ohlone voice and the indigenous voice to the Gill Tract, which I think is really important, not only because I want to see our public institutions like the University of California involved in conversations around reparations and healing from the genocide of indigenous people in this country, but also because I want to see those universities prioritizing some of those life ways, some of that knowledge, those regenerative practices that evolved in place, were site-specific, and therefore are often very appropriate for a specific location. And if we're trying to figure out how to combat a food system being ravaged by monoculture, both socially and agriculturally, we have a lot to learn from indigenous people. So that's some of the exciting news there on the 2.5 acres that we saved through the occupation.
So one of the things that we know about land-grant universities is that land-grant universities were granted land in order to fulfill their mandate in supporting agricultural and mechanical training, so engineering and agriculture, for the new settlers, and that land that they were granted obviously was land that belonged to someone else or to other communities. So the sale of public land is, you know, inherent in the land-grant university system, and many land-grant university systems have been selling their lands, their research lands, their extension station lands. In the past decade, there's been a real decline in the acreage available for public research, public breeding. There's been an increase in the privatization of these breeding programs to the detriment of traditional breeds and open, essentially the open source research information that the public deserves. The University of Kentucky has sold off most of its farmland. It's now a strip as you come into Lexington. And there's other examples that my brain is not accessing in this moment. But do you want to talk a little bit about the community response and the kind of indignation or another way of saying that would be, what is the vision that the community held for what this land should be? Because I think there's a pretty strong public consensus about what public lands should do. that doesn't necessarily always align with what the university administrators think, but, you know, did you find a pretty clear awareness within the public of what they thought the land should be used for? And how did you go about that?
Yeah, well, as is captured really beautifully in the film, you know, when our group, Occupy the Farm, Grassroots Direct Action Group, got involved, it was part of a much larger struggle that had been going on for decades by people in the community around the farm that had for over 20 years been asking for that land to be protected and to be used for agricultural research and education. So I heard about it as a student at the University of California when I studied agroecology with Miguel Altieri, who basically stood in front of his class and said, "Hey, you students, what are you going to do about this?" You know, this had been a place where really important sustainable agricultural research had been done for decades, and it was on the brink of being paved. So we really benefited and stood on the shoulders of these communities that had said, "Hey, we know what we want here." You know, there had been proposals, like I said, that Alice Waters had been involved in, that multiple stakeholders from the community had been involved in, that said, "We want to see this be a place where children can come and learn about agriculture." It's in the middle of the city. This spot is 20 acres of prime agricultural land in the San Francisco Bay.
Todd, do you want to talk about the community's voice that you heard in the film?
Yeah, it was really interesting because the university, you know, it operates under a charter signed by Abraham Lincoln that says that they have to teach farming. And this piece of land was their last farm, and they were going to pave it over with condos and a shopping center. So the community, many members of the community have been concerned about this land for years. And when Effie and the other farmers, you know, cut the padlock off and walked in and started planting vegetables, it was like this big invitation for people to, you know, families, kids, you know, whomever, to walk onto the land. And while not everyone loved them, they got a very positive response and a huge outpouring of support from the neighbors. And this confounded the university. And so the amount of concern and community support and activity from people who, you know, who were always, you know, curious about the land and worried about the land kind of, you know, undid their plans. And at no point during the occupation was it a sure deal that they were going to win. In fact, everyone was saying, people who, quote-unquote, knew the deal, said, "Oh, yeah, this is a foregone, this is a done deal. These people are never going to win. It's nice that they're trying this, but they're not going to be victorious." But in fact, you know, the community outpouring embarrassed the university, and the real estate deal collapsed. And it was really because of the community support of this very creative direct action that they were able to win. So if there hadn't been a sort of a public concern and a public, you know, a pretty high level of public support, I don't think they would have, you know, been, you know, near as successful. Because it was by no means an assured outcome, and the public nature of this land, people were really upset that the university would essentially privatize their last farm when their charter says they're supposed to teach farming.
So again, the public land and the public discourse about how land is used can happen nicely in the public when there's a press and there's a stunt and there's a dialogue and it's university land. It's harder in the private sector, the conversations about stewardship and the decisions that are being made across the country by thousands of individuals on their private property are, you know, much more sacrosanct in our country as a result of our particular history of settlement. And the way that the enclosure of our land was related to the building of our nation and the founding of our democracy and a whole bunch of really awesome rhetoric that many of us believe very strongly in. And yet, the contestation over this public land is a really powerful window to a larger discourse about land reform, who has access to land under what term, at what cost, and under what governance structure. And that's a conversation that's in that contestation that's going on in many other locations. And I know Effie, as a result of this occupation in Oakland or in rather in Albany, is that right, Albany? Yeah.
Yeah.
That you were able to go and visit with the MST in Brazil. I wonder if you could reflect a little bit of your experience there and, again, situating this particular kind of opening for dialogue. What does it mean to you?
Mm-hmm, for sure. So for sure, this sort of reflection of what's happening in the Global South, and particularly with organizations like the MST, the Landless Workers Movement of Brazil, was hugely inspirational to our work at the Gil Tract in using the tactic of occupation, where other community efforts had failed. So with the MST, they have for decades now been using occupations to reclaim land for displaced people, for working people, for people aspiring to be farmers, doing up to about a five-year occupation, which by no means is easy. It is not necessarily supported by an overwhelming majority of the local community or by Brazilians at large. This is a social movement, something that has this larger political message, as well as trying to meet the material needs of the people that are participating. The MST is supported by parts of their constitution that say that land must be used for a social function. And so if land is sitting fallow, or they've even started to develop it further, where they're going into university-owned property, they're going into fields owned by Monsanto, they're reclaiming those spaces as well. It started out as just fallow land that they were reclaiming, but at this point, they're really asking the public and asking the law to examine this definition of social function, and reclaiming land for those purposes that have been used by huge monocultures, international agribusiness. So visiting with the MST and seeing how they're working happened after, as you said, after we had our initial occupation. With our initial occupation, we had exchanges, letter exchanges with folks within the MST that, gave us huge messages of solidarity and encouragement. And then afterwards, what I saw there was that it is not just a rural movement. It's very much something that is in the urban areas as well. It's something that's connected to worker struggles. It's something that's connected to establishing community centers, trying to build housing that folks can afford, and it's kind of centers around this identity of a person, of a worker.
Talk into the microphone, Effie.
Sorry, how's that? it's the MST, as I said, works for material benefits, but also is hugely focused on political education and identity. Identity as a worker, identity as someone who deserves land, who can fight for land. And so that's something that I hope that people who are excited about food, excited about farming, can explore these larger tactics that we're seeing around the world. If they're having difficulty, which most of us are, is the biggest question, how do we get land? That they can perhaps look to community, building community and finding land that is unused that they might use to grow food for the benefit of the community. And this is something that is really tricky, can get really tricky for folks in communities that they may not necessarily have been a part of for a long time. So specifically in Oakland, we see white folks with a lot of class privilege or some degree of upward mobility going into communities where they can reclaim land, that they can really only have the privilege of doing that because these are communities that have kind of been neglected by the city, city structures and investment there, and trying to claim space. And I think it's really important for people to think about who is living here, who is being displaced. If I'm coming in here, to create those networks of accountability, conversation, of deep connection, before we are taking space.
So we don't have very many more minutes to talk, but I want to just point to some of the places where this kind of dialogue about land rights, land access, land reform, land occupation is going on. We have a land news blog on the Agrarian Trust, agrariantrust.org. There's an amazing set of thinkers, although they are not getting the headlines. You know, it's not as popular as PASTA, but land rights are a powerful discourse that's been going for quite a long time in this, you know, all around the world. And the questions of political economy, of justice that are raised by by the policies and structures and ownership regimes that cause about 30% of our food to be grown on about 70% of the land, which is the industrial ag system, and then about 70% of our food globally grown on about 30% of the land, which is those farms that are still in what could be considered a more peasant-based subsistence, diversified small family farm operation context. So this confrontation between agribusiness, large-scale monoculture export, global exchange, and a more regional, local peasant economies has been a standoff for years and for centuries. These issues have arisen and continue to arise as we look forward at the structures of our farm policy, the $60 billion we've spent from taxpayer money subsidizing the largest 4% in the last 10 years of agribusiness operators with our subsidized crop insurance. You know, what are we as a society interested to see on the land that is ours? This is too much to go into right now, but I would really love to just bookmark the fact that we're going to keep talking about this. This is an area where there is not a broad consensus, and I think there's a growing sense that our interests, our health, our environmental, our social, and our fiduciary best interests are not being met, and that we have a lot of re-examining to do. So another really great place to just point towards is a magazine called The Land, which is published out of England, which Greenhorns distributes. It's a quarterly magazine on land rights issues, major focus on the UK, where they've had a lively debate ever since the enclosure of the Commons, but news from all around the world. Any final thoughts, Todd, about where to find the movie? How, if people want to organize a screening of this movie, can they get access?
Anyone wants to,
seems like it'd be a great thing for people to have Grange halls or community halls or schools and colleges and libraries with budgets or librarians to meet and convince. What should they do, Todd?
They can send an email to us at occupythefarmfilm@gmail.com. That's occupythefarmfilm@gmail.com. That's all run together. And they can also go to our website, occupythefarmfilm.com. The film can be, individuals can watch the film on iTunes, Amazon, and that sort of platform. But then please get in touch with us. We love doing community screenings. The film sparks a great conversation. The film is... it's gotten good reviews, I can say that, and I think it's an exciting film, and it never fails to spark a good conversation. I would also like to add, to sort of expand a little bit on what Effie had to say about people accessing land. I think in around the country, the laws and the land situation is varied. The people in Occupy the Farm were smart to use a true diversity of tactics. I mean, they not only did they cut the padlock off the gate of that farm to save it, they also went to city council meetings and did that sort of very, you know, dreary-seeming sort of work. But with all the zoning laws, with all the covenants on land, with all the public patchwork of land, water rights, what have you, everybody needs to sort of be interested in this issue if they dig into the issue in their own locality and really find out the specifics. I think windows will open up if people are persistent. But we would love to be able to show the film in any corner of the country. Anyone can hear our voices. We would love to come to your community and show the film. So please get in touch with us at OccupyTheFarmFilm@gmail.com.
Awesome. Got to get this man a Rise Up account. So one of the things to just know is that San Francisco has been a very powerful urban agriculture context. They passed a really cool rule called AB 151, I think it's called, which gave an incentive, a tax incentive to landowners who make their land available on a five-year basis to urban farmers. So, yes, I think that's an important point to make, is there's a variety of tactics. There's negotiation, there's handshake, there's lease, there's community governance, there's community land trust, there's all sorts of relevant ways. One other organization to just mention here is 596 Acres, 596acres.org, which is an organization in Brooklyn that supports communities with land access for urban growing. They have a whole toolkit of legal approaches and template language and all the things that you would need in order to, having identified a piece of land in your community, take action to get access. So I think we've run out completely of time, but I want to thank you all for your work and encourage everyone to click here. Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.